content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, the dire meaning of Gallup's announcement. This article written by David Frum. Last week, the polling firm Gallup announced that it would no longer survey presidential approval ratings. This news stirred suspicions. President Trump's numbers are declining badly, much worse than Joe Biden's at the equivalent point in his presidency. Gallup's most recent presidential approval poll in December had Trump at 36%, well below the Real Clear Politics poll average of 42%. Trump is known for taking punitive action. He sued the Des Moines Register and its pollster, Ann Seltzer, for an ego-bruising 2024 survey that suggested he might lose Iowa to Kamala Harris. Other companies targeted by the president appear to have folded. When sued by Trump in cases that many legal experts expected them to win easily, CBS and ABC paid huge settlements to Trump's presidential library fund. On Monday, Stephen Colbert told his Late Show viewers that his bosses at CBS had scrapped his taped interview with James Tallarico, a Democratic Senate primary candidate in Texas, owing to threats from Brendan Carr, the chair of the Federal Communications Commission. Had Gallup taken the next logical step toward appeasing Trump's vindictive ego? Assuming the worst is often prudent, but Gallup's own explanation, citing changes in the company's business strategy, makes a sad commercial sense. Quality polling companies such as Gallup inhabit a world of rising costs, declining rewards, and multiplying competition. Polling worked because people once accepted a call on the phone the same way they accepted jury duty, as one of the small obligations of citizenship that helped democracy work better. Large numbers of citizens have come to perceive the institutions of democracy as unfriendly to them. The dispassionate stranger on the phone inquiring how a citizen intended to vote and why is one of those institutions. Iowa-born George H. Gallup taught Americans the power of modern polling during the 1936 presidential campaign. Until then, election prediction had been dominated by a magazine called the Literary Digest. In 1916 and every 4 years thereafter, the Literary Digest mailed postcards to a large sample of Americans to ask them how they intended to vote. These surveys successfully predicted the squeaker election of 1916, then the Republican landslides of 1920, 24, and 1928, and Franklin D. Roosevelt's victory in 1932. In 1936, the Literary Digest reached out to a record 10 million Americans, about a quarter of whom replied. Their answers predicted a crushing rejection of the Roosevelt administration and the triumphant election of Republican Alf Landon and his running mate, Frank Knox. Gallup, who turned 35 in 1936, had launched a research company the year before. To promote his work, he undertook his own election survey in 1936. Gallup reached only 50,000 people, a pitiful fraction of the Literary Digest's awe-inspiring mailbag. He predicted, correctly, a solid Roosevelt win. Why did Gallup succeed where the Literary Digest failed? The latter got its list of addresses from places such as state automobile registration lists and local telephone exchanges. In the Depression, people who had their own phone number, let alone a car, and also felt so passionately about the race as to take the time to answer a survey, were disproportionately Republican. Roosevelt's strength lay in the much larger number of Americans who went without such things, and who were not seething with anger that they wanted to share by mail. The Literary Digest sample was huge but unrepresentative. Gallup's sample was smaller, but more representative. His fame was made. A new industry was born. For decades, Gallup's company and its imitators improved their techniques. Then things began going wrong. As the frequency of polling intensified and caller ID caught on, Americans ceased picking up the phone. In the late 1990s, 28% of those contacted by Gallup agreed to participate in a poll. By 2017, only 7% agreed. At present, the company's response rate is down to 5%, a Gallup spokesperson confirmed to me by email. That figure is typical for the industry. In other words, in the late 1990s, Gallup had to place about 3,500 calls to build a 1,000-person sample. Today, it must place 20,000 such calls. Obviously, that costs much more. The difficulty of building sample groups leads to a second and more insidious problem. As fewer Americans answer surveys, are those who do inherently non-representative? Are they more cooperative or more opinionated, or in some other way, simply different from the 95% who decline to participate? There are ways to correct this problem. Courtney Kennedy, the Vice President of Methods and Innovation at Pew Research Center, told me that because survey respondents are more likely to claim they volunteer for civic and charitable causes than Americans do generally, the organization overweights the answers of those who say that they don't volunteer to make the sample more representative of the country. Developing workarounds like this, too, costs money. For many pollsters, the costs are covered by media partners. ABC News often hires Ipsos. The New York Times uses the Siena Research Institute. Much of the country's best polling is done by nonprofit foundations, such as Pew, or by affiliates of educational institutions, such as the Quinnipiac University and the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. Gallup, however, is a profit-seeking company that earns its living by doing commissioned research for governments and corporations. In 2006, CNN and Gallup ended their long partnership. Since then, Gallup has operated its presidential approval research for more or less the same reason that department stores install shop window displays at Christmas, in the hope that this public amenity might bring more traffic through the door. However, that hope was often misplaced. Over time, new technologies made it easy for anyone to create an attention-grabbing poll that met minimal standards of respectability. Remember the 1994 survey that claimed that more young Americans believed in UFOs than believed they would collect Social Security? The poll's methods were misleading, but earned countless headlines nonetheless. In the internet age, the attention economy elevated returns on investment for bad polls, and the returns on good polls correspondingly diminished. Some companies have responded by developing new methods. Morning Consult, which often partners with Politico, collects very large samples, sometimes in the tens of thousands, by recruiting people online, which costs less than conducting phone calls. The hope is that the large size of the sample offsets concerns about the demographics of respondents. All of these methods, traditional and high-tech, have been called into question in the past decade by the worst series of shocks to the U.S. polling industry since Gallup predicted that the Republican candidate Thomas Dewey would defeat incumbent President Truman in the election of 1948. In 2016, election eve polls showed Hillary Clinton beating Trump by an average of 3.2 percentage points. Nate Silver's 538, which aggregated high-quality polls, projected that Clinton would win 302 electoral votes. She was favored in Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Instead, Clinton lost those five states and beat Trump in the popular vote by only 2.1 points. She won just 232 electoral votes. What went wrong with the 2016 polls? First, the decline of local newspapers and television stations shrank the resources available for state polling. Many of the polls that purported to measure opinion in swing states relied on smaller samples and weaker methods. The bigger problem was that even the best polls failed to measure what was important. Every pollster must begin with a theory about what the American electorate might look like in the coming election year. Typically, the people most likely to vote are older, better educated, more affluent, and more trusting of institutions than the American adult population as a whole. Yet Trump powerfully appealed to Americans who were less educated, less affluent, and more alienated from institutions. People, in other words, who might not show up in a polling sample recruited by traditional methods, but who showed up at the polls when Trump headed the ticket. Pollsters received an early warning that their methods were under-measuring the disaffected. In June of 2016, most polls predicted that British voters would elect to remain in the European Union. Of seven major surveys, only one, which gathered resources online, a conventionally frowned-upon method, accurately predicted that a British majority would vote to leave the EU. Pollsters readjusted their methods and weightings, yet they never quite caught up. In 2024, the consensus forecast again underestimated Trump. The core of the polling problem seems to be the changing public itself. How does a company measure public opinion when a big segment of public opinion results being measured, and when that segment is not randomly distributed, but concentrates behind certain kinds of politicians, such as Trump, or certain kinds of political movements, such as Brexit? When Gallup's methods showed Trump 6 points lower than the polling consensus, does that reveal something about Trump? Or does it reveal that methods that worked well in a cohesive, pro-social, pro-institutional country are mismeasuring a polarized country that contains a large anti-social, anti-institutional minority waiting to be mobilized by the right leader? The Gallup poll once seemed to be nothing less than the voice of the people. The Gallup poll now departs for the same Valhalla as the three big broadcast networks, bowling leagues, and roast beef for Sunday dinner. Institutions that were once almost universally accepted, but did not survive into a more divided and mutually suspicious America. Our second story comes from the family section. American kids used to eat everything, by Olga Kazan. The most striking passages in Picky, a forthcoming book by the historian Helen Zoe Veit, describes the way 19th century American figures ate as children. I found myself gripped with envy as I read, not because the food were particularly appetizing, but because I would kill for my kid to eat like that. To wit, as a girl, Edith Wharton adored oyster sauce, turtle, stewed celery, cooked tomatoes, and lima beans and cream. Mark Twain fondly remembered eating succotash, string beans, squirrels, and rabbits on his uncle's farm. And during her childhood, Veit writes, Elizabeth Cady Stanton happily ate vegetables, hickory nuts, and cold jellied brain. If these kids don't sound like typical kid foods, that's because they aren't and weren't. Kid food, as a category, is a recent invention. According to Veit, American kids weren't picky until the early 20th century. Indeed, the word picky came into widespread usage around then. Before that, Veit writes, children in the United States ate spicy relishes, vinegary pickles, wild plants, and a huge variety of animal species and organ meats. They slurped up raw oysters and looked forward to their daily coffee. Fennel seeds and tomatoes were considered treats. According to Veit, the ideal that kids are naturally neophobic or very wary of new tastes is a myth. Eating like a child, Veit explains, was once understood to mean being overly excited and undiscriminating about food, not being picky. In the 1860s, a doctor wrote that children generally ate, quote, anything and everything, end quote. Veit's book recounts how kids went from eating jellied brain to consuming, like any toddler, little but macaroni and cheese. A big part of the story, as she tells it, is that American kids used to be hungrier at mealtimes, which meant they were more eager to eat anything. Before the 20th century, many children did hours of chores both before and after school, so they worked up a good appetite. Maybe Twain was hungry for those string beans because he spent so much time hunting wild turkeys and clubbing pigeons. Few kids snacked between meals because processed foods weren't widely available. In addition, parents tended to be confident that children could learn to like most adult foods. If a child didn't like a given meal, they generally wouldn't be offered an alternative because, due to the lack of refrigeration, no other food was on hand. But after a series of societal changes in the 20th century, Veit writes, the children were less hungry, the food was less delicious, and pickiness was born. First, children's appetites waned because they became less active. As more Americans moved into cities and more families bought cars, fewer kids walked miles to school or performed farm chores. This coincided with a major shift in the American diet. Thanks to pasteurization and stepped-up government regulations, milk became much safer to drink in the 20th century, and food experts began to see it as essential. The standard recommendation for children in the 1930s and 40s was a quart of milk a day, or roughly 600 calories of it. All that milk made kids less hungry for solid foods. Doctors eventually lowered their recommendation to 2 or 3 servings of dairy a day. But by then, snacking had emerged as another hunger dampener. Food companies began manufacturing snack cakes, cereals, and cookies, and suggesting that parents buy special foods for their kids. Meanwhile, a misguided progressive-era public health campaign encouraged parents to serve their children easily digested foods, such as eggs, broths, and gruel. Because child nutrition experts at the time had little knowledge of germ theory, they claimed that rich and flavorful foods were the culprits for children constantly getting sick, and thus advised that kids should be given only bland foods with few condiments. Children's foods, they said, should be seasoned with just salt, onion juice, or a splash of milk. Even butter was considered too rich by some nutritionists, no longer recommended giving kids bland food, but the idea that children should eat different foods from adults nevertheless stuck. Advice to parents on how to address pickiness in their children also shifted over time. Prior to the 1940s and 50s, Veit writes, the standard guidance was to just let food-refusing children go hungry until the next meal. But mid-century experts such as Clara Davis and Benjamin Spock suggested that children instinctively choose a healthy diet on their own, without their parents prodding. In fact, they argued, without evidence, parents who urged their children to try a bite of fish, say, might make them hate fish and turn them into picky eaters. All of this gives the impression that a good mother is one who presents a plate of food and sits silently by as her child pokes at it half-heartedly. If he refuses the meal, she offers something else. Changes in food options and advice have created a country in which the majority of kids' daily calories come from ultra-processed foods. American kids today eat so poorly, Veit writes, that they are actually getting shorter. At the same time, she notes, parents are exhausted by the struggle of getting picky eaters to eat. She reassures parents that pickiness is not their fault, but it often feels like it is. My son Evan became picky the way people go bankrupt, gradually, then suddenly. I distinctly remember him eating peas and coleslaw as a baby, but over time he grew less and less adventurous. Now, at nearly 2, pretty much all he eats is pasta. My husband and I tried many of the tricks suggested to me by friends and by the internet. We've tried telling him that beans are pasta. He begs to differ. We've tried blending vegetables into his pasta sauce. We've tried giving him a small amount of his safe food, or pasta, along with some new foods to try. Veit's recommendations to reduce pickiness differ from these solutions, and some of them seem, well, more hardcore. She suggests restoring the appropriate feeling of hunger at mealtime by limiting the amount of snacks and milk the children have between meals. She recommends affectionately and persistently encouraging the child to try a rejected food at the same meal, including, perhaps, by popping a small amount of food into her mouth when she's distracted. Crucially, she argues, parents should not offer alternative foods if a child won't eat a meal. Even reading that last one felt shocking. Forcing Evan to eat what I make or else to go hungry seemed so wrong. I was a kid once, after all, and I hated it when adults pressured me to eat things I didn't like. Sure, every day I would slather him in sunscreen as he screams, and I shove a toothbrush between his locked little jaws, but I can't bring myself to have a standoff over spinach. When I called Nancy Zucker, a Duke psychiatrist who works with extremely picky kids, she told me that she agreed with some of Veit's techniques, but not others. She endorsed having set snack times that don't interfere with meals. Kids thrive on knowing, this is when we eat, this is when we don't, she said. And she acknowledged that children probably have more sophisticated palates than adults may think. Many of her patients, she said, are actually craving flavor. Zucker's guidance to her patients depends on the specifics of the family she's working with. But for many of them, her first step is to encourage families to restore positive associations with food and eating, having fun grocery shopping or cooking together without expecting that the kid will become an instant cauliflower convert. She also thinks parents should reconsider how they engage with their kids at the dinner table. For many families, she said, mealtime is like a sports commentary where parents are constantly, take a bite of this. Would you be having fun if you were the kid? Since reading Veit's book, I've tried some of her strategies and have been pleasantly surprised. One day I withheld a snack after daycare, even as Evan hopped around the kitchen yelling, Mama, cookie. He ate a bit of salmon that night and sampled some of the broccoli before spitting it out. Another night, pushing dinner a half hour later made him proclaim that a homemade soup with visible chicken pieces was tasty. But when he completely rejects an entire dinner, I still heat up something I know he'll like. Eventually, I want him to eat oysters, but for now, I just want him to be full. Today's third story, Crypto is a Victim of Its Own Success, by James Surowiecki. The past few months have been disastrous for cryptocurrencies. Even after bouncing back a bit, Bitcoin is now down almost 50% from its all-time high last October, and other cryptocurrencies, including well-established ones such as Ethereum and Solana, have fallen far further. Crypto winters are nothing new. The biggest drop in Bitcoin's history in 2011 knocked 99% of it off its value. But this one feels especially painful because it came at a moment when crypto enthusiasts thought they had finally made it. Donald Trump's election finally gave the industry a president who was unavowedly crypto-friendly. Trump appointed regulators who, unlike those under Joe Biden, showed no interest in limiting crypto's spread or cracking down on crypto exchanges. In October, he pardoned the founder of the biggest crypto exchange, Binance, who had been convicted of violating U.S. law by failing to adequately prevent money laundering on the site. Trump even put out crypto coins of his own days before his inauguration, the value of which, like most meme coins, skyrocketed before collapsing. Crypto seemed well served by the fact that it had become more enmeshed than ever into the global financial system, and more mainstream in terms of public awareness and interest. The assumption was that this would make Bitcoin and crypto generally more stable and reliable, and protect it from the vicious sell-offs in the past. But in fact, its integration into the financial system, which helped boost Bitcoin last year, has helped accelerate its fall. It wasn't supposed to be this way. The growth of crypto exchanges such as Binance had made trading Bitcoin and other currencies much easier for retail investors, as did a boom in crypto exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, which led investors not only to buy and sell crypto, but leverage their bets. Institutional investors were also more open to treating crypto as a legitimate asset class, adding Bitcoin to their portfolios. And there was a boom in what are now known as digital asset treasury companies, publicly traded companies whose main business was raising capital to buy crypto, and who presented their strategy as a kind of perpetual money-making machine. Buying crypto drove up the stocks of these companies, allowing them to then sell stock to raise money to buy crypto, which drove their stock up. More generally, the institutionalization of crypto has left the currencies without a clear hook to bring new buyers in. The psychological fervor that pushed up crypto prices has always depended on the currency's reputation for being radical and disruptive. As crypto became more established, investors looking for excitement have moved on to alternatives such as prediction markets, which are both more novel and more comprehensive than crypto. That's why analysts and investors now say things like, the narrative has stalled, and lament the lack of a new story to help explain why crypto is stuck. There's nothing to galvanize people into buying crypto now. No obvious catalyst to make people think, I better enter that market. It hardly helps that other investments have offered higher returns and with less risk. Bitcoin has actually underperformed the S&P 500 over the past 5 years, despite being far, far more volatile. So the mainstreaming of crypto has, ironically, made it harder, not easier, for it to rebound quickly, the way it has so often before. The decline in sentiment and interest is especially important because crypto's value depends not on any meaningful economic fundamentals, the way the value of a stock does, but rather on how people feel about it. To be sure, plenty of people still think Bitcoin is valuable. A currency that was trading at barely more than $0 in 2010 is now valued at nearly $69,000 a coin. And it has always bounced back after steep sell-offs before. But this is a new world for crypto, one in which digital currencies feel less like rebel upstarts and more like an eccentric uncle. Everyone expects crypto to either keep tumbling or rebound sharply. But predicting what comes next is impossible because its fundamental worth relies too heavily on storytelling, and its advocates haven't found a new story to sell. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us the next time. We hope you've enjoyed it listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.